Welcome to the Book Chat for Your Podcast. I'm John Purcell and I'm sitting here with Sarah Majuli. And we're excited to have Kelly Dowse join us. Welcome, Kelly.
Thanks for having me.
Now you're here to talk about your new novel, Dressing the Deer Loves. Can you tell us a little bit about the novel so we, because I often forget this bit and I'm getting in now before Sarah can say it.
Yeah, often we like veer straight off topic at the beginning, but let's begin with your beautiful book, Dressing the Deer Loves.
Okay, well, what can I say? Sylvie is my protagonist. She is 30 years old. She's from England, but she's been living in New York for the last 6 or so years and working as a fashion designer. And the book begins with some little excerpts of articles, web blogs and various things which show you very quickly that Sylvie has had a real fall from grace and she's failed spectacularly with her business. And she's coming back to England to her family home with her tail between her legs, looking for refuge. And when she arrives, her parents, who have been living in this fallen down mansion for years and cobbling together whatever they can to make ends meet and to keep afloat, have decided to sell the family home. So at that very moment when she needs refuge, everything's changing. So that's what the story starts with.
And the Deer Love family is not your ordinary family. Can you give us, I mean, I don't want to give things away, but how far can we go into that family and sort of talk about their sort of the past and who they all are?
Well, Sylvie has this perception that her family have had a very glamorous past. They have. Her great-grandmother Rose was a society doyenne and hostess from the 1920s. Her grandmother was a 60s icon. She was a groupie, sort of a la Almost Famous or Bebe Buell or any of those like very well-known groupies who followed bands like the Rolling Stones around the world. And her father's a very famous abstract artist. And she always felt growing up that she had to do something to make her mark on the world, and that was always the expectation that she would. All the Deer Loves do something extraordinary. And now that she's failed with her business, she's really questioning who she is and in coming back home starts to find out more about who her family is, who they really are.
I really love Sylvie. I think both John and I are in the midst of reading your book, but I sort of fell for her really quickly from the beginning, where she shows up accidentally stealing money from homeless people and dropping cigarette ash all over the place and just being in a state of chaos and disruption. Where did she come from? Like, where did you first get the idea for her?
Well, the idea for the story overall came first. So the concept of the story was really, it came from watching one of those BBC miniseries on very penniless aristocrats who were living in the modern day world trying to keep up their family homes, and they know that just to fix a roof will cost millions of pounds and they have no money left, so they're wearing holy cashmere and they have cut glass accents but not two pennies to rub together. So I just love that concept of people living in these 100 bedroom mansions and they're only living in two rooms because they couldn't afford to heat anything else, and they really just were living so poorly, like below the poverty line. So that's where the idea for the book came from. But Sylvie, really, she's drawn, I guess she's a pastiche of lots of people I've known, of maybe me when I was younger. Just that idea of feeling like you've no idea where you're going and how you're going to get on your feet in the world, how you're going to make some sort of impact or do something that you can be proud of, but feeling like you're failing all the time.
There's a sense of that risk that people take when they go out on the creative line. Like there's that sense of that it's a tightrope, that there's definitely no net, that if you are creative, it is a more risky path to take. And in this sense, you've got generations of people who are trying to live life in a bigger, probably more fulfilling way, but it often leaves you in living in a house that is falling around your ears. Do you feel that as a, because, you know, we all know just how difficult it is to make a living doing the thing you love, if it's art, if it's creative, if it's writing, if it's playwriting, whatever it happens to be, there is a level of risk to it. But also they're the best people. Sorry, in my opinion.
I know. I'm terrible like that. I do think that those are very interesting people to meet and to talk to, and people that follow the things that really bring them great joy and that they're passionate about. I'm always interested to talk to those people. I'm certainly not snobbish about what people do, as long as they love it. I find it really bizarre when somebody doesn't enjoy what they do for work or on a day-to-day basis, because I can't really understand why you choose to live your life that way. Anything is better than that.
Yeah, you think so. But yeah, you know, so many people just go for that security, you know, the continual paycheck, and what they give up for that paycheck is enormous.
I mean, not everyone, it's not as though everyone in the world is denying their creative life. Some people some people don't.
But we wandered away from the creative side. We're just looking, even if you... you dreamt of being a gardener, but you've ended up being a tax agent.
Oh, follow your dreams.
Yeah, follow your dreams.
Some people's dreams are to be hugely rich and successful.
I know, but
yes.
Generally you find people who get there like what they're doing.
Yeah.
And the reason why they put the extra hours in to be rich and successful is because they're obsessed with what they're doing.
It's funny, I can't mention who it is, but I was having this conversation with someone very close to me the other day who was saying, you know, I'm just actually not that passionate about anything. And I thought, well, that's not true. You wouldn't be in my life if you weren't a passionate person. But they're not passionate necessarily about work, but they are passionate about the way they live their life. And so I think, you know, passion has to come into it.
Everyone's got something.
Yeah, I think so. And for me it is, I feel very fortunate because I get a great deal of joy out of work. And I think about it all the time, and whether it's what I do day to day or my writing or all the things that I'm interested in, I just get a lot of, it feeds me quite a lot.
How are you, because with all these conflicting interests and all of them take up time, how are you managing it? Because you're working in publishing, you're writing, you've also, you've got another life as the Crafty Minx. So there's all these different things that go on. There's so many things going on in your life. How do you pass it all out? Are you a good manager? Is that there?
I honestly think that becoming a mum, my daughter's just about to turn 10, was probably the most galvanising thing that ever happened to me, because it just made me very good at prioritising. So up until the point that she was born, I always thought that I'd write, or I always thought I'd do certain things, and I dabbled and I was doing some freelance writing as well as working in publishing, but I just never felt that sort of push to do it. But I think when I had her, I thought, well, it's now or never. And I had that little window of time on supposed maternity leave. I actually had no break really at all. I got the contract for the first book 4 days before she was born, and it was due in 3 months. So I then had a nervous breakdown, and my husband, who works in IT, said, let's just put together an Excel spreadsheet. How many pages do you think you can write a day? And so I've always worked at it like that. It's really like prioritizing and thinking, not beating myself up, and just thinking, I just need to get to whatever my word count was in a day. And even if it's rubbish, at least I did it. And quite often I'd find there were definitely days where 200 words was like eking out something very painful. But then other days I'd write 3,000 or 4,000 words and it just seemed to flow really well. So I think it's just that discipline and practice of sitting down. And also everything was always done in snatched moments and always is. I mean, this morning I woke up and I knew I've got to get a blog post off to HarperCollins about this book. So I sat there for an hour and a half and just made myself write this blog post. And you just do it because you have to and have to fit it in somehow.
I think it's really beautiful, though, that your daughter sort of brought that out and inspired you to, like, do the thing.
I think it's part of sort of being a mum and running a household and everything. It's just I think you just get really good at prioritizing. I remember prior to having her going to the office, and, you know, you'd wander around the office and you'd have chats and, you know, all those water cooler conversations and various other things you do and events. And now I'm just very much, I get to work and I've got my head down. It's not that it's not fun. It is. It's just I'm very focused these days. I try to be.
Now, dressing the dealer ticks a lot of boxes for me. I love a crumbling old mansion. I love an eccentric family. I love old, long-buried family secrets, and weaving and out through time. So, but what caught me by surprise in this one is something that in my life I'm not hugely interested in fashion, right? Like I like pretty dresses and stuff, but it's not something I take a huge interest in. But this book really brings home how, like, it brings clothes forward as a personal, like, window into the past and, like, a great way of examining history and family history and just how personal the clothes that we wear are. How much, like, basically, can we talk about the clothes?
I love talking about the clothes. I'm all about the clothes. No, I just love clothes so much, and I couldn't write something that didn't inject that into it. I'm just a sucker for pretty dresses and fashion and, almost an embarrassingly high consumer of things, but that's how I got into vintage fashion and why I'm interested in it, because I revel in it. I really enjoy it. And I was in Canberra actually last weekend, and I went to the National Gallery, and they had some incredible, like, V&A and Poiret clothes from the 1920s and the Belle Epoque and some Ballet Russe outfits and that sort of thing. Yeah, I could just look at that for days. I love it.
I love how much that comes through in the writing, though, and how so much I love reading a book that makes me re-examine things like that and like peer behind the curtain of a whole industry and a whole, like, thing and just think how much goes into it and how much more beautiful and amazing it is than you may have realised.
Well, I actually cut out great swathes of too much exposition in the book and too much information about the fashion industry. My very dear girlfriend, Jess, is a fashion designer. Oh, she was a fashion designer. She's an artist now. But she worked in sort of high consumption fashion for a streetwear label, a high street label that, you know, was turning around clothes very quickly. And she told me some extraordinary stories about the way the fashion industry works. And so I really wanted to weave all of that into the book. And it actually all got cut because it just felt a bit extraneous. But it was fun to explore it. And I hope that the feeling of that still remains, even though I cut it all out.
I think definitely. I think the emotion of it is there. You just maybe lost some of the facts. Like, and the important thing is the love of clothes and just the historical tie. Like, we examine history more often through photographs and written words, and, but, you know, we wear clothes every day and we spend a lot of money on clothes. And thinking of that as a way to connect to your own family members and your own family history, it's really cool.
Well, I can't think of clothes ever as at face value. I'll look at something that just comes out in the shops and I look at all the allusions to previous eras that they've pulled out.
Because so you're an expert.
Oh, not really. I mean, just through the love of it, you just find out information. But say, for example, I mean, I'm just wearing this Zara jacket that I actually bought at the markets, at Kirribilli Markets, but it's got these bold shoulders and that's very 40s. And that was because of the war, because the clothes then were being modelled upon uniforms.
I love that you know all of this. Like, that's fascinating to me. For someone who doesn't know that, who does take clothes at face value often. Like, I like my clothes, and I'm not interested in clothes, but I don't know the history of clothes in that way.
Well, it excites me too. I mean, the reason I put this on today is because I associate that era with the emancipation of women, because women really came into their own in that era because they were suddenly doing jobs that they'd never been given before, and they were keeping the home fires burning while the men were away at work, and it was really a time of great advances and happiness for a lot of women who are being given that opportunity to go out into the working world. So it always makes me feel strong to put on something with shoulder pads because that reminds me of that era. It's weird, but that's the way I think.
Cool. I find that fascinating. Also makes me want to own some more clothes, which is
I mean, it's also the impression that these sort of shoulders can give of Joan Collins. So, I mean, you know.
40s, not 80s, John. 40s. 40s.
Well, that's why the power dressing was there, right?
That's right. They started to pull out. The 80s was when they, well, actually, I think all throughout history they've often drawn from earlier eras, but in the 80s they had a very strong 50s movement, which was when Grease came out. They just fell in love with the 50s again because Grease came out. So you see lots of dresses in even in vintage clothing stores and they'll say, oh, it's a 1950s dress, but it's not. It's an 80s dress that was modelled upon something from the 50s. And similarly, all that Dynasty and Dallas stuff is all modelled on the 40s. So it's strong, kick-ass women.
And when you say that, obviously I can see it, but it's just something I've never thought about. And it's these connections, like the retro thing with fashion coming in and out and stuff, it's something that I notice in music sometimes and, you know, in other areas. I rarely think about it in terms of clothes, and that's why, I mean, I get a real kick out of that. Like sort of absorbing someone else's expertise and getting and allowing it to sort of view things in a different way. I'm not expressing this very well.
Yeah.
But I understand what you're saying. I mean, I feel like that with music too. I love it when you hear people talking about music and influences, and you can even hear it in what you listen to. I mean, I like that band Haim, and they sound so like Fleetwood Mac to me, who I also love.
Yeah.
And, you know, similarly, because I grew up with all those 70s bands, my parents were really into all the 70s music, and you just hear it replicated again and again. For years, I loved Kings of Leon because they just had that whole 70s sound again, and it's just, it's interesting, isn't it?
It is, but sometimes it takes someone with a wealth of expertise to write a book like this to get someone who doesn't think about clothes in that way to sort of start thinking about clothes in that way.
Well, I hope it's not too saturated because I didn't want it to be, you know, instructive about fashion.
No.
But it's just the setting, and I loved that I could, both of my books, Precious Things, the last one, was really because I had a friend who worked in an auction house, and I thought, oh, in another life, I would love to have her job as an auction dealer. And then in this book, it was the same thing. It's just, you know, if I wasn't in publishing, which is my first love, I would do those things. I mean, you know, bar being a rock star, which I would have loved, but, you know, musical ability aside.
You could be
the Oh, I would love to have a rock star character. My friend Jenny Valentish did that for Cherry Bomb. Her book Cherry Bomb, she had she did a sort of rock star lead character, and it was very cool. She did a lot better than I could, though.
I don't know. I look forward to your potential rock star book.
The next book is I'm cross with you because last time we spoke about Precious Things, I distinctly said I wanted a book set in Italy around.
You did.
In Precious Things, there's a segment because there's a lot of different eras in Precious Things, and it sort of follows the.
It follows a sort of vintage collar that's taken from a wedding dress. It's stitched the night before one of the characters' weddings in 1890s Normandy in France, and then it follows for the next century all these different women that own it.
And they all wear it in different ways. They all do different things to it.
Yeah, some of them wear it as a headpiece, and some wear it as a sort of bodice, like a belt almost. It's sort of incorporated into all these different pieces. Because I've actually come across pieces like that through vintage hunting for years, you know, where you can see that they've been reused as different things. But you did like Bella, my 1950s character.
I thought it was fantastic, in Italy. And the I was really hoping that you'd get sucked, because it felt like you got a little bit sucked into that period as well, and I you did it so well. I was like, oh, I love more.
John's mad.
That's very kind. My favourite character in that book, and I think I had too many characters in that book, because
fantastic.
Well, I enjoyed writing them. Hopefully other people enjoyed reading them, but the my favourite character was Lexi, the 1920s circus performer, who was sort of based on, you know, Wim Wenders' film Wings of Desire, you know, how he had that trapeze artist and the angel. And mm-hmm. I fell in love with that idea of a trapeze artist when I watched that film. So she's a very different character, but, I love those tropes and then playing with them.
I haven't read Precious Things, but can I just say these snatches of it make me think that I need to rectify that immediately.
I will give you a copy.
Okay. Kelly, thank you so much for coming down and talking to us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Fun chats.
And you can get hold of Kelly's books at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.